Hello and welcome to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. My name is Megan Rudkai, and I'm here with your co-hosts, Franz Ocelia and Zachary Wheeler.
Today we're joined by Professor Sebastian Schmidt, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University. Professor Schmidt teaches the course U.S. Foreign Policy, which Zach and I both take. And we want to thank you very much for joining us today, Professor Schmidt.
Oh, you're welcome.
Today we'll be discussing U.S. foreign policy under President Donald Trump, specifically focusing on the themes of continuity and change. We hope you enjoy the podcast.
So our first question is, historically, with some exceptions here and there, U.S. foreign policy over the past 70 years has followed the path of liberal internationalism. As the theme of this podcast is continuity and change, could you give a brief overview of what liberal internationalism is and why it has stuck as traditional U.S. foreign policy?
So liberal internationalism, you know, you could kind of think of sort of the establishment of the multilateral international institutions in the post-World War order as kind of a foundational moment that we are sort of still living with today, right? You have the establishment of the UN, the IMF, the World Bank, the trade regime, and so forth. And, you know, liberal internationalism is essentially, from the perspective of the United States, the idea that it redounds to the interest of the United States to be actively involved in international politics and to support the legitimacy of multilateral institutions that were largely established by the United States to serve the interests of the United States, and also to support the spread of democracy and human rights and so forth, because, you know, in terms of understanding, I mean, there's a popular idea that democracies don't fight each other, democratic peace. And the idea is that if democracy spreads, that redounds to the benefit of the United States as well. So liberal internationalism is in general a foreign policy that basically supports the continued elaboration of a multilateral institutional framework, and that supports or that encourages the continued involvement of the United States in world affairs, essentially, and also for to the continuing support of an open trade regime, right? So you've got sort of the foundations of economic interdependence as a foundation of peace. You have relations of between democracies as a foundation of peace, and sort of the support of the most powerful nation in the world as also a guarantor of sort of peace and stability. That's generally the idea, and has generally been pursued, of course, you know, with fairly wide latitude in specific policies over the last, you know, 70 or so years.
Wow. Well, thank you very much, Professor. Mm-hmm. That was a very thorough and definitely concise answer, Franz.
Oh, yeah. And moving on from the start of these liberal internationalism, right after the post-war, right after the Cold War ended, then we have, could you elaborate on the shifts that the Bush administration with neoconservatism applied to the foreign policy of the United States, and then as well as the Obama retrenchment that cooled off that some might argue that cool off the internationalism of the United States.
Right, right. So, I'll briefly mention Clinton too. Just you know, sort of the early post Cold War years when there was no sort of pure competitor to the United States in terms of security politics. Clinton got quite involved in humanitarian intervention, which is in extension, perhaps in some sense, in a more activist extension of liberal internationalism, but intervening for human rights. These were mostly fairly problematic interventions that, you know, resulted in part in sort of frozen conflicts, and it's unclear exactly, you know, the long-term benefits of it. I mean, there's clearly, you know, for instance, in the case of Bosnia, it stopped mass killings from happening, which is good, of course. You know, but Bosnia is still sort of a country that's kind of stitched together by the international community. The same holds for Kosovo and so forth. And basically, domestically, there was little interest in investing sort of blood and treasure in humanitarian interventions abroad. And so Bush originally came into office sort of promising, I forgot exactly the word that was, a humble foreign policy, I think it was something along those lines were the words used. Yeah. Which is, of course, not what we got, because 9/11 intervened, right? And then, you know, there were folks involved in the Bush administration from early on that had been much more activist in terms of their interest in democracy promotion and nation building. And, you know, this, for instance, Paul Wolfowitz, and particularly Paul Wolfowitz, actually. And in 9/11 kind of brought together this idea of security threats emerging from the periphery of world politics in weak states and so forth. And of course, there's the intervention in Afghanistan, which of course necessarily ended up in sort of as a state building mission. And then of course, the war in Iraq, which as well became kind of a state building mission and was seen by some neoconservatives as the potential to sort of have this reverse domino effect where you have the democratization of the Middle East after you invade and successfully establish democracy in Iraq, which of course is totally no problem, you know. sorry, I don't mean to be flippant about it, but, you know, neoconservatism is essentially, it's actually not too far removed from the ideas of liberal internationalism. Like a lot of people thought that, you know, these neocons, you know, where are they coming from? This is like radical and different. It's actually not in some ways that radically different from essentially a aggressive liberal internationalism
plus.
Right, yeah, in terms of, you know, I mean, there the emphasis is not on multilateral diplomacy and institutions. There is the emphasis more sort of on primacy and the power of the United States to essentially implement a vision for the spread of democracy in the peripheries, in these areas where at the time and today still the focus is on these potential emerging threats of terrorist networks and weakly governed states with weak institutions. And the solution was sort of spreading democracy essentially at the end of a barrel of a gun, right? And so the methods were very different, right? But I mean, it's important to keep in mind that sort of this, the call for regime change in Iraq actually predates the Bush administration, sort of stems out of the Clinton years. And essentially, 9/11 gave the political leeway, arguably, or definitely, because I have difficulty explaining the Iraq war to myself in any other way, gave the Bush administration the political leeway to invade Iraq, essentially, and try to actualize this sort of neoconservative dream of spreading democracy.
And then with Obama.
With the Obama, right. So with the Obama administration, we see fairly significant retrenchment. This is, of course, after sort of the post-invasion catastrophe in Iraq and the insurgency and the surge as a response and sort of the sort of stabilization of Iraq. And then, of course, under the Bush years, the negotiation of American troop withdrawal. Obama and his national security staff were very interested in essentially getting out of these what at that point had come to be seen as sort of interminable wars in the Middle East, right, or Central Asia in Afghanistan. And the argument there is that Obama withdrew, or the popular argument is that he withdrew too precipitously from Iraq, although it was not completely up to him, given that the status of forces agreement had already been signed. And in Afghanistan, where Obama first copied the surge strategy, right, but was pretty intent on having American troops withdrawn by the end of his second term, okay, which is not the case, you know, in the United States, with this gap that opened up, this power vacuum in Iraq that opened up, you had, in the Syrian Civil War, it's, of course, deeply linked to that, is the rise of ISIS, naturally, which sort of started in the ruins of Syria and kind of emerged and spread fairly quickly to Iraq, and the biggest city under ISIS control was Mosul, you know, which is a very large city, and was under ISIS control for a very long time, and that was made possible by the weakness of the Iraqi regime. So there was criticism that he withdrew too quickly. His phrase was sort of, you know, we need nation building at home, right? And this is, I mean, keeping in mind also, this is during the financial crisis, or immediately after the financial crisis, 2008, right? Where you have this massive government intervention in the economy to sort of keep it afloat and preserve liquidity. There was definitely a policy interest in the Obama administration to sort of turn the focus back to domestic politics. And critics would say he essentially went too far and retrenched too quickly, particularly in the Middle East. One of the bigger criticisms of the Obama foreign policy is this, the red lines with Syria, right? Right. And the use of chemical weapons, which turn out to be not so red lines and so forth. And I think that's a fair criticism to make because you repeatedly say, you know, this is unacceptable. And then you kind of...
And then there was no action.
There's right. no action, correct. Yeah, there's no military action, right? Right. In a sense, the Russians sort of came in to sort of provide this sort of political solution of removing the precursors of chemicals. Now we see, of course, we have had subsequent chemical attacks in Syria.
Not quite to the scale, but...
Right, yeah.
And some might say that that's actually the bigger deal, the fact that the geopolitical implications of not doing anything allowed Russia to have a role in the
right, yeah, exactly. I mean, and here's, you know, where you get to sort of the sticky problem of more fundamental questions of foreign policy is how involved do you think America needs to be? Okay, right, right. By not getting involved in Syria very deeply, yes, it's certainly opened up Syria to active intervention by the Russians. I mean, the Iranians are a major player on the ground, actually not only in Syria, but now also in Iraq. Mm-hmm. Okay, and the idea is that, yes, with more active American intervention, the Russians and the Iranians would have less leverage in that part of the Middle East. But then you always have to think about what the cost of that active intervention is, of course, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, you can basically ensure the outcome you desire in Syria by, you know, invading and, you know, mm-hmm. committing hundreds of thousands of troops there. But, you know, and then, of course, you box out the Russians and Iranians. Great. But, you know, then you've got essentially another Iraq war in your hands, right?
Right.
And so I am personally now speaking a little suspect of the idea that a lot of the stuff that goes on in the world is actually really directly, you know, influenceable or can directly be influenced by the United States. And
right.
I mean, to some level, yes, but there are always costs that are involved, right?
Right.
Now, with the Obama red lines, it's very easy to say, you know, that was a political mistake to make these red lines, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think in the political culture of the United States has gotten very used to the executive taking military action without consulting Congress. And Obama actually, for him personally, sees it as sort of an important moment in his administration that he didn't do the knee-jerk reaction bombing Syria thing, even though they had used chemical weapons, because he says, you know, this is the playbook in the American foreign policy establishment that is essentially bipartisan, is that you go in with the military and you do airstrikes. And he actually, for himself, even though he concedes that politically it was sort of a disaster, he sees it as sort of in some ways sort of triumphant that he didn't do the knee-jerk reaction. Now, it cost him politically very much so. It's one of the major criticisms of his foreign policy is that he sort of let these red lines go, right? But it's funny because he actually submitted the question to Congress and there was no support for taking military action. So you could say, you know, constitutionally, he was on safer ground because
right.
he consulted Congress before using force. And of course, the Republicans didn't want him to do him any favors or anything like that. And so there was no support for a strike. Now, I'm willing to bet counterfactually, of course, that if he had just, you know, launched a bunch of cruise missiles, like people would be applauding him. Right?
Yeah.
You know, whether that would be effective or not is a whole nother thing. Of course, intervention got, you know, exponentially more difficult once the Russians really got involved, because then you got to make sure you're not killing Russian soldiers, right?
Right, so you have to tell them in advance
yeah.
we're going to attack, and
you
then the Russians
tell
the Syrians. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to bomb, you know, is it okay if we bomb here or here? And Russia says, sure, and then tells Assad, you know, they're going to bomb here or here. Now, so that being said, when Obama did his whole red line thing, it would have been easier to strike Syria there because the Russians weren't that deeply involved at that point.
Right.
You didn't have the fear of this, you know, killing Russian soldiers thing. Now it's much more difficult. I mean, the strikes that Trump has carried out have essentially, from my understanding, been symbolic, right? I mean, you know, he struck last year from a gas attack, and of course the following year we have another gas attack, so clearly the strike wasn't
so... Yeah, it didn't do much.
It wasn't very deterrent, you know. So sorry, I don't know if I've won.
No, this is perfect, Professor Schmidt. And
okay.
I'm going to listen to this at least three times before a final. So,
okay.
So I think we've established a pretty good baseline, right? We talked about liberal internationalism, that tradition. We talked about the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, and the Obama administration. So now that we have our baseline of what a traditional U.S. foreign policy looks like, how would you compare that to Trump in general? I mean, he's only been in office for... now almost 2 years, but you know, a year and a half. How would you compare, and what continuities do you see? What changes do you see, just in general? And what's your opinion? Very, very broad question. So
yeah, you know, it's hard to really. I mean, because he's only been in office a little bit, and not only that, he's had so much turnover in personnel. You know, when people like H.R. McMaster were there, you could kind of bet that, you know, things would be. You know, there would be more continuity because of sort of this established, you know, direction of U.S. policy that is essentially, you know, has long provenance, and the whole bureaucracy is kind of, you know, there's sort of like a bandwidth in terms of acceptable policies, and that doesn't really change that much from president to president, right? With the high turnover, in the Trump administration, and you know, it's really hard to say. Like, he's not, and you know, this kind of goes a little bit into domestic politics too. He doesn't use the same language as other presidents do in terms of, you know, support for democracy, emphasizing liberal democratic institutions, you know, abroad and, you know, at home too, it has to be said. You know, he's just not, that's not what he does. He's extremely transactional. I think he has a very strong sense of self in terms of his ability to make deals. You know, honestly, I've yet to actually see a deal. You know, I don't see deals. I don't really, you know, see anything. You know, maybe that'll change right now. I see the end of the Iran deal. That's what I see. But I don't see, like, you know, the self-professed deal maker actually, you know, right, making deals. And I mean, so I guess at this point, you can definitely say there's been a stepping back from sort of liberal internationalist bent of American foreign policy. You know, he's made quite a bit of his dislike of the Iraq war, but apparently, you know, if you go back into what he actually says, he was sort of for it before he was against it. Like, actually most Democrats at the right, time too were for it before they were against it. And you know, I think, but I would say he's certainly against sort of investment in nation building, right? And in that sense, actually, there's a continuity from the Obama administration, right? This idea that, you know, the United States, you know, certain things just lay without, are outside of the power of the United States to influence, you know, with any degree of certainty. And Obama was not excited about nation building abroad. I think actually Trump is very similarly not excited about nation building abroad. That said, he seems to be more interested or more confident in the use of American power, that it could actually influence the world in ways according to American interests. He has very little interest in sort of multilateral approaches. I think that's also fairly clear, questioning the NATO commitment, all this kind of stuff. You know, it's, you know, and also has to be say he seeks better relations essentially with autocrats, right? A few accepted, you know, he doesn't seek better relations with Iran, but of course he's very interested in a better relation with Putin. I sort of failed to see a little bit, you know, what the United States gets out of better relations with Putin. And also, I don't think there's a real cognizance of what that would cost, right, to get better relations with Putin, okay? You know, better relations with Putin would come at the price of essentially, you know, letting them or letting the Russian influence grow in Syria, persist in eastern Ukraine, you know, in Crimea and so forth. I mean, so there, and if you're going to meet Putin halfway on those things, you know, it's questionable as to what you actually get from that. Mm-hmm. You know, he just makes a big deal out of good relations with Russia. I just don't really see that as
advantageous,
you know. I mean, there's just, you know, what's in it for the United States in that sense, you know. And of course, you know, you could say, like, well, personally, there might financially be a lot in it for Trump, or, you know, some of his detractors would say, depending on what comes out of all the probes. But I just don't see, like, why the emphasis and, you know, what great things would come out of this, right? China is clearly the much more important country in terms of economics and also sort of future military balancing, in terms of, you know, what, in terms of reaching an understanding with China, you know, and having good relations with China. I think that's much more focal, basically, and important. You know, Trump has used military force, right, these strikes in Iran. But again, I see that as essentially cosmetic strikes, okay? I mean, they're sort of a show of force, which he's very much into with his interest in military parades and, you know, using force. It's sort of ingratiating for himself and to, I'm certain to members of his political base and domestically. But it's unclear what that actually does. You know, the United States essentially is pulling out, or he's expressed strong interest in the United States pulling out completely of out of Syria, because we do have some forces on the ground. Now, if that's not sort of Obama's wish list, I don't know what is, right? I mean, in a sense, it's sort of like, it's actually less involved than Obama would be there, right? So right. For all of his criticism of the Obama administration as weak and indecisive and, you know, there are some interesting continuities there. Now, of course, a big change is stepping back from the Iran deal. And I guess I've always thought, you know, I don't really see, I mean, Iran, what's sort of ironic about American policy, and this is sort of like long-term American policy in the Middle East, is that we've done things that have actually helped Iran a lot, okay? And for better or for worse, I mean, you could say like sort of in terms of unintended consequences, right? The Iraq war was a huge help to Iran because it took out sort of his sort of sworn local enemy, you know, they shared a really long border with, right? And Iran's influence in Iraq has grown exponentially since then. Now there's sort of a direct connection with his, with Iranian allies in Syria, okay, and in Lebanon, right? You see sort of like this web of Iranian influence that's really expanding because of the Iraq war, okay? And of course, also now because of the civil war in Syria, where the Russians and Iranians are really major players at this point. And in fact, the Taliban had also been kind of a headache for Iran. And, you know, obviously the United States had strong interest in removing the Taliban from power. But you could also see that as essentially also, you know, another sort of set of circumstances that actually aided Iran. Now, with the nuclear deal, you know, you could argue, would have been possible to get, better terms, that you don't have these sunset provisions, that the controls end or whatnot. But I mean, the problem is if you want to renegotiate the deal, you don't think the deal is very good. And I think, you know, I mean, I don't know the specifics, but in general, you know, there probably might have been room to push for, you know, at least longer sunset provisions or something like that. But now that Trump is stepping out of the deal, essentially, you know, what the deal did is it actually removed quite a bit of enriched uranium. It put a lot of Iranian centrifuges into storage. It opened up Iran to what is apparently very intrusive inspections. And if the deal falls apart, then you actually lose all those advantages. So the only reason that you'd step out of the deal is if you had a better deal to step into.
Right.
And without that, it's not clear, you know, what's the plan B? The issue here with the Trump administration, there never seems to really be a plan B, right?
Right. It's these, like, impulsive decisions that, or maybe not necessarily impulsive, but without second thought.
Right.
I just don't get the sense of a real plan.
Right.
Okay.
And, I mean, we've seen the Trump administration pull out of the TPP,
mm-hmm.
Threaten NAFTA,
mm-hmm.
threaten NATO, and threaten the international order that the United States built mm-hmm. over the last 7 years. Now, I guess the question that that scholars and everyone else is going to be asking themselves is whether or not this is the new normal for the Republican Party
and
foreign policy status quo.
Yeah, I think one way to think about this is that basically, you know, there are a lot of people who didn't like sort of Trump's optics or persona, but, you know, when he would be president, he would change. I mean, he's clearly the man 70-something years old. He's not going to change. I'm not going to change when I'm 70. That's fine. You know, he basically carries over his approach to deal making in private life that he does in public life. And what that means is, I mean, he's been involved in like 3,500 lawsuits or some ridiculous number, right?
Right.
He essentially uses brinkmanship a lot, you know, upping the stakes and the ante to bring, to kind of stress a situation to essentially resolve it more to his liking. And so I think you're basically seeing that now. You know, his approach is that he's willing to do something like discard the Iran deal to increase the stakes, in the hope that, you know, because...
Right, with no plan B, right? That's totally brinkmanship.
Yeah. Right, yeah. It's sort of like brinkmanship in the sense that you kind of increase pressure in the hopes that it then ends up breaking your way, I guess. And that's, you know...
There's also the, you know, possibility that you collide and it causes the horrible...
Right, yeah. I mean, well, you know, he's been through like six bankruptcies, you know, and so not everything's gone his way in his private life. So I think, you know, I think it's... I mean, that's the sense that I get. He's sort of more willing to boss and push around allies, you know, getting, for instance, NATO partners to increase their defense spending or whatnot, right? You know, questioning Article 5 commitments to put the pressure on security, you know, these allies in the security alliance to get them to kind of, you know, and like, you know, yes, that's a strategy. And I can see that it could work in some ways. I'm not saying it's not, or you know, for instance, with the talks in North Korea, agreeing to meet one-on-one with Kim Jong-un, which was usually held out as essentially a reward for good North Korean behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's kind of just offering it like that. And I'm not saying that, it's inappropriate in all cases, like that, you know, sometimes different approaches can prove useful, particularly if you've been in sort of a policy paradigm for a long time. You know, I'm not saying that's automatically bad or whatnot. It's just his approach is much more riskier, and it puts a lot of pressure on existing institutions. And it's the question of how wise that is. You know, you could make the argument, well, he's pushing around his allies because he can push around allies, right? Right. It's like, yeah, but, you know, at some point after a while, if you kind of take this to the extreme, then, you know, you kind of fray those relationships, right?
Yeah, that was the, you know, the article we read for your class, G. John Ickenberry, The Plot Against U.S. Foreign Policy, where he essentially says, sure, Trump might get, you know, a couple better deals here and there by bullying allies, but we're essentially degrading this system of multilateralism that we've created for 70 years, right? You know, I just think that's really interesting. And he, I mean, you know, in that article, he's skeptical whether or not the international, you know, liberal internationalism will survive, which I think is an interesting question, is like, you know, is everything going to be all right after Trump's presidency? But, you know, once again, that's, you know, we don't know. We're only 2 years in, but...
And so now that we've talked about all of the ways that Trump is sort of diverging from this international liberalism, you know, what are some ways that maybe he's maintaining it? You know, are there any points of continuity, or is, you know, liberal internationalism?
Right, like we talked about Obama and, you know, the continuation of, you know, like some continuation in Syria, and, but, you know, are there any like really big things that stick out to you that just seems like just normal U.S. foreign policy?
Well, it's normal in the sense that, or there's continuity in the sense, you know, that he questions Article 5 commitments, but NATO is still around, right? Or he says, we have to renegotiate NAFTA. It's horrible, horrible, horrible. And, you know, we're like a year and a half in, and yeah, there are negotiations about NAFTA, but, you know, they're certainly not going to scrap it, right? How he pulls out of the TPP, but then says, well, you know, seeing that other nations essentially proceed, with the TPP. It's like, well, you know, I'm going to hold out this possibility of, you know, rejoining it under certain, you know, for fair trade, you know. So I don't think, I mean, and I think part of this is that, you know, I mean, he's a total political novice, of course, right? I think part of this is also essentially the inertia of the bureaucracy, you know, that it, and the people that he's appointed who've kind of come from political backgrounds and more or less experienced, you know, that there, it's not like it's, I mean, the Ickenberry article is sort of like, you know, this could be the end of the world.
Right.
It's a little bit, you know.
The plot against U.S. foreign policy.
You know, right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's a little bit in grandiose terms. Like, I don't think this is the end of the liberal international order. I think at the end of the day, particularly economically, there's just too much at stake. I mean, you know, the irony of these, you know, steel tariffs against China is that, you know, I was listening to, I think it was NPR the other day, they were talking to a bunch of, you know, local industries about steel tariffs, and there's one that uses imported Japanese steel to make really fine fish hooks, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
And like, so what's going to happen? Well, you know, people just end up buying Chinese fish hooks, right? So you've, you know, you've put a tariff on Chinese steel, but then it actually encourages, you know, buying Chinese import. I mean, so it's just like, these things are really complicated, and I think the fallout from doing anything radically different, particularly in trade politics, because, I mean, the economy is just so globalized at a level, like, that it just has not been before in terms of supply chains and sort of, you know, follow-on effects of tariffs, that, you know, there's just a dominant interest in continuing some form, particularly the economic openness of the international economy, right? And China, of course, is, you know, they certainly have a very slanted industrial policy and picking national winners and favorites and stuff like that, and, you know, all these non-tariff barriers, but they are also interested in continued, you know, economic relations, right? So I think the economic side of it is a little bit safer than the liberal, you know, the politically liberal side of it, right? Because you do have this sort of these nationalist trends that are just not just in the United States, but of course in Europe and so forth, and of course Russia, where you see backsliding in terms of liberal norms. I think that's more concerning, because Trump, given his demeanor, his interests, he's just not in a place to really be interested to do anything about that. For instance, at this moment, if we had sort of some hypothetical, you know, standard American president or whatnot, they'd probably be giving speeches about the importance of democracy and institutions, you know, particularly in Central and Eastern Europe, and, you know, recalling, you know, the founding principles of NATO. I mean, you don't see Trump doing any of that, you know. I can't even really, and even the speeches where he does, sort of slide into that kind of mode, you can, they're totally scripted, and he's incredibly cramped. Like, he never...
It's his totally different speaking
yeah.
style.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He, you know, he talks in complete sentences.
The speech yesterday.
Right, yeah.
When he announced the Iran deal, he was his typical, you know, very closed off, self reading the teleprompter.
Right. Yeah, so. I mean, I couldn't imagine sort of like Trump off the cuff, you know, like waxing poetically about, you know, the importance of the liberal order and stuff. So I do think that there's an issue there, right? You know, it all depends on the strength of the institutions. So basically, I mean, I have a little bit more concern there. I don't think we're going to be doing that much backsliding, at least in the United States, because we do have, you know, sort of a very active culture, sort of in the, you know, the ACLU, you know, civil liberties, things like that. Like, I don't think we're going to see that much backsliding in the United States. I'm more concerned about Central Europe, I guess. And Trump is not really in the position, at least rhetorically, to oppose those developments.
Right.
And in fact, he's like, you know, things like the Front National in France is great and all, you know, all this kind of stuff. I mean, so it is concerning a little bit, but I guess I'm just sort of more optimistic in that regard. I can very does see it as sort of like the end of the potential end of the world. And it's to be concerned about. Yes.
Right.
But, you know, I think we're okay still.
No,
okay,
no,
that's definitely good to know.
Right. No, shifting
crystal ball.
No, shifting gears for a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a line of argument out there that says that due to the Bush administration's concentration in counterterrorism and then the Obama administration's relinquishing of some leadership positions in the world, that we might be returning to an era of great power politics,
mm-hmm.
where Russia and China and then, I guess, Iran in the Middle East as well, might have more say in what the world order becomes. Mm-hmm. So to that end, to what extent has the Trump administration returned American foreign policy to fit the great power politics that governed states' actions before the Great War?
Yeah, so like before the First World War, right? Yeah, I think I mentioned this before, like the idea that, you know, history is like super important, but like you'll never get things repeating in the same way, obviously, because, you know, the baseline conditions and the foundations sort of change as you go along, right? And I think... You know, the 1990s really was a time where, you know, what does uniparty mean? I don't want to, like, sit here and define it as a political scientist. It's a very squishy concept. But, you know, if you're going to think of a unipolar moment, the 1990s sort of were it, right? Russia was essentially a basket case, in the words of my advisor, John Mearsheimer, or former advisor.
Mm-hmm.
China was not sort of like the economic behemoth it was now. So it really was sort of like, what's the United States doing and what are its interests? You know, that's going to essentially run world politics, right? And today, it's without a doubt, it's very different. Both because of the military modernization of Russia and the more antagonistic policies it's pursued, but especially the economic development and military and elaboration of the Chinese military instrument, right? But we are in a world that is sort of very, very different. So pre-World War I, Europe was incredibly sort of globalized, at least on a European scale. Trade made up a huge portion of nations' GDP. There was essentially the gold standard, so you didn't even really have currency fluctuations, right? I mean, it was incredibly economically open. But, you know, there were no international institutions really to speak of, and there's some sort of Hague conferences and so forth. But, you know, we have this massive institutional framework, and these things are real things too, right? The United Nations is a physical building with a budget, and, you know, the World Trade Organization is like a really elaborated, you know, bureaucracy. And, you know, these are actual institutions that, and they are important fora for continuous kind of negotiation. The whole idea is that, you know, this isn't the days where the ambassador was like the most important guy in your relations with another state. You know, you basically have essentially ongoing negotiations at all levels in these international institutions, right? And so it's a very different picture than it was before the First World War. And I think there's comparisons to economic interdependence before the First World War and today are sort of specious, not only for that, but also because the economy is essentially fundamentally different, right? I mean, there was much more, you know, industrial production, raw material procurement from, you know, the colonies at that time. Today, it's sort of distributed supply chains and, you know, massive... foreign investment, foreign direct investment, you know, also portfolio investment all over the world, emerging markets. I mean, it's just a very different beast. So when people say, you know, we're going to have a return to great power politics, you know, what it's hard to say really what that means, I guess, in the sense that, you know, these institutions will have some staying power despite, you know, fears of their erosion or whatnot, because there are powerful states that have continued interest in these institutions, right? And so I would say, you know, we will see increased, or there's possibility for increased security competition between the major powers, let's say France, United States, not France, like Russia, the United States, and China. But I also have sort of like this pet theory, and this is just totally going off the rails, and something I want to think about a little bit more, right? Is that, you know, if we think about security, like actual security politics and actually fighting wars, you know, regardless, you know, if you say that, you know, the stability and instability paradox is true and that you can have conventional war without the danger of nuclear war, let's say, right, between the major powers, you know, like a real actual hot war between the United States and China on the conventional level would last like a couple of days, because then we'd blow everything we built up, and then, you know, we build destroyers at a pace of like 2 a year. Or something, right? Because there's so much capital investment in every single ship in the Navy. You know, like the cheapest ones, these LCSs are like, you know, littoral combat ships, which are essentially unarmed, you know, hulls. I mean, you know, people joke about a little crappy ship, right? But they're $500 million, you know, and they take a long time to build, you know? And, we build Virginia-class submarines, again, at about one or two a year, you know? We don't have that many. Like, how intense... I mean, if there's actually a conventional face-off, it's not like in the World War II, you know, as recent as World War II, where you could be churning out Liberty ships, you know, hundreds a year, right. You know, or something like that. It's just the technology, the material foundations for conventional conflict are just so fundamentally different. You know, it requires an amazing amount of human capital. You know, 100 years ago, you toss some recruit, you know, a rifle, you know, just fresh off the farm, 18 or something, and then within like a couple weeks, you have sort of a rudimentary soldier that you send to the front. It's just not happening anymore, right? And so in a weird way, like, I think, and I'm, you know, I haven't read the literature on this, or if there is, I have no idea. There's...
The Graham Allison book, the Thucydides Trap, like, that I think that has gotten some recent attention. It's just about, like, will conflict happen between the U.S. and China? It's really interesting. We talked about it on CIP.
Oh, yeah, the CIP.
With Stephen David. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, that's okay. It's just, like, conflict is so costly, even in a conventional sense. Like, I have a hard... And maybe it's a product of my time, but there's never been a major conventional war against a great power in my lifetime, so maybe just for that reason I can't really conceive it. But if it were to happen, it would... like, replenishing the conventional forces is something that just happens at such long timescales. I mean, we started building this F-35 like almost, you know, 15 years ago or something, you know, and it's still like, I'm not even sure if it's reached operational capability yet.
Right, is that the stealth fighter?
Yeah, it's just so insanely complex, right? And it's not just a thing, it's not just a plane, it's this whole network, essentially, a way of fighting war, that it's, you know, it's like we're building these amazing precision capabilities for, like, you know, plinking insurgents in the developing world, because we can't afford to actually use it against, you know, peer competitors, right? Sorry. But I mean, that's why I'm kind of skeptical. Like, we're not going to see the great power politics of before the First World War.
Right. It's just different, fundamentally different.
Yeah, and I really question, like, you know, I mean, that's not to say we won't have crises, we won't have security concerns, we won't have, you know, the threat of conflict, without a doubt. Like, you know, in the Cold War, nuclear arsenals were attempted, there was an attempt to get political leverage out of them, and there's some argument that say, that sort of worked. You know, maybe we'll probably see the same thing with conventional stuff, you know, that you use it as leverage, maybe, and so it is, you know, useful, but, you know, full-on war is just, I think...
Not feasible anymore.
Well, sorry?
Not feasible.
Not in the same way, yeah, as it used to be, at least.
So then, if it's not conventional warfare or great power politics, what do you think is sort of the biggest threat of our time? Is it then non-state actors?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're seeing now, you know, basically what's happening, and there are a number of causes of, or what I see is happening. I always have to preface that what I see, because, you know, whatever, it's just what I see, right? Mm-hmm. we, as time goes on, and this is a really more of a complicated and sort of like deep, you know, question, is that we're basically seeing the distinction between war and peace essentially blur, you know, into a sense that, you know, whereas before, you know, especially, you know, prior to the Second World War, you know, it's pretty clear when you're at war and when you're at peace, except when you're fighting American Indians, because then you're always at war, but that doesn't really count because they're just American Indian. I mean, you know, this from the sort of like the white, you know, white man's kind of perspective, you know, right, that those didn't count, right, you know, because they weren't declared war. But I mean, in the sense that there's sort of like this time in great power politics when it was clear when you're at war and when you're at peace. And the Cold War already is kind of like a weird in-between stage, right? It's like, ooh, okay, we're not fighting Russia, but it's not really at peace, right? But, you know, it's not a hot war, right? So then the distinction, you have the new distinction between Cold Wars and hot wars, right? Prior to the Second World War, that doesn't make any sense. There's no Cold War and hot, there's just war and peace, right? Mm-hmm. Then in post-Second World War, you've got Cold Wars and hot wars, and then you've got like proxy wars, and then, you know, you've got like other sort of permutations on that. And then with the United States now, you know, sort of, I mean, we've been technically sort of like at war, I don't know, like constantly since essentially 9/11, right? You know,
Syria and Libya,
right? You know, yeah, and Iraq, and we're kind of like back in Iraq now, sort of maybe, and then we're still in Afghanistan, is sort of continuing. So I think. I'm sorry, I just totally lost track of your question.
No, just, I think you're bringing up hugely important points that, you know, this war isn't our biggest threat, but it's kind of going on.
Right, yeah, it's kind of going on all the time, right? So if I had to say, like, what's a threat, you know, because then, right, is war against non-state actors war? Well, mm-hmm. You know, yes and no. I mean, you know, what's the greatest, you know, threat in this sense? I mean, I guess, yeah, in the sense of, I mean, I don't want to sound too neoconish here, but sort of like, it would be a disaster if a non-state actor actually got its hands on a nuclear weapon. I don't think that they can really develop them for themselves. I think there's no interest on the part of any country to actually hand off a nuclear weapon to a non-state actor. So it would more, if that were to happen, it'd be kind of like an inside job, essentially. Right, or theft or something along those lines. But I think the probability of that, so I think in terms of like actual physical threats, in terms of, you know, violence, that's probably the most concerning, but I think that it's also extremely remote, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm not here advocating, you know, we gotta go and like, you know, just like run all over the world and like try to eliminate all non-state, you know, or something like that. Like it just doesn't, like, I think it's a very remote possibility. I mean, I think actually, you know, in terms of actual violence, you know, I mean, the United States is actually really quite secure. You know, that's right. I'm trying to think, you know, saying that, like, am I, like, totally missing something? And I don't really...
I mean, we talk about in Professor Dewdney's class, we talk about these existential threats to essentially the world. So,
right.
You know, we've gone through many different phases. So nuclear war, bioweapons, you know, chemical weapons. And now there's, you know, he has this futurist kind of AI and information warfare, which I think is interesting. But it's just kind of like this look at, you know, what may threaten U.S.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I see it's sort of like, and I don't know nothing about like AI or, you know, things like that.
Right.
And so, you know, I mean, I would just say, you know, I kind of think in terms of nuclear conflict, like, I basically think deterrence works, you know, generally when it
applies. Well, empirically, it's worked, right?
Right, empirically, it's worked, you know. But you know, people think, you know, for instance, with Iran getting a nuclear weapon, I think it's very hard at this point to prevent countries from getting nuclear weapons because, you know, North Korea developed a nuclear weapon and they were sanctioned and isolated and all this kind of stuff, right?
It still happened.
Right, and it still happened. And so, you know, do I want Iran to get nuclear weapons? Especially like this regime in Iran? No, I don't. But if they do, is it the end of the world? No, it's not, I don't think, right? I don't think they would ever hand off, I mean, they would never knowingly hand off a nuclear weapon. And, you know, nuclear weapons can't, particularly small arsenals, it can't be used for, you know, blackmail and, you know, sort of getting other states to do what they don't want to do. They're not really useful for that. There's a paper that made a good argument, you know, what if Saddam Hussein had nuclear weapons and invaded Kuwait? You know, the argument basically was just like...
Nothing changes.
Nothing would really change. The only time it would change is that if you threaten regime change, because then if the regime has nothing left to lose, yeah, then it would...
Last resort.
Yeah, as a last resort, it might reach for nukes. So basically, nuclear weapons defend core interests. So if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, that doesn't necessarily give it more leverage to sort of expand necessarily its influence in other countries. Now, again, do I think it's a good... If they get nuclear weapons, no, I don't. But, you know, I also think that it's not, like, automatically horrible and we're going to have... I mean, I think what it'll do, it'll encourage more proliferation. And the danger with nuclear weapons is that just with more actors having nuclear weapons, you increase the likelihood that there's going to be a mistake, right, that there's going to be unintentional escalation, perhaps, or that there's going to be theft or something. So on the main, I think it's better to have as few nuclear powers as possible, basically.
Right. And I think just to, I mean, all great discussion, but just to shift gears one last time, and then we'll probably wrap up just because of time constraints. Mm-hmm. But I think you have a lot of people today who would maybe listen to this podcast and say, well, empirically, if you look at Trump's presidency, mm-hmm, especially recently, there's been a lot of winning, or, you know, quote unquote winning, right? So take a look at the economy. It's, you know, you have economists saying it's doing so well, it might be overheating. And then you have people saying, you know, look at our most recent diplomatic, I can't think of the word, diplomatic leader of North Korea, which, you know, it's the first time a North Korean president has ever stepped into South Korea and, like, you know, all these different, and the possibility of nuclear denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula, you know, potential.
Nobel Peace Prize.
Right, yeah. Nobel Peace Prize, the end of the Korean War. And also, you know, even today, there was the release of three North Korean prisoners, of, you know, American prisoners in North Korea. So what would you say to the people that say, look at all these empirical things that Trump has done and clearly we're winning? Or would you just say, well, yeah, that's the question.
Okay. Yeah, no, it's a good question. I mean, I think there's a couple things, you know, so in terms of North Korea, the one thing that Trump had done over 2017 was to basically turn up the rhetoric and sort of more aggressive military postures as well. And actually, 2017 was a bad year, you know, I mean, for American relations with North Korea, in the sense that Kim Jong-un essentially, you know, verified to himself that he has a nuclear capability, and a fairly reliable intermediate range ballistic missile capability. Now, whether he actually has an ICBM capability is debatable, probably not. You know, he's done one test of that. You know, it probably not really reliably clear if that could actually threaten the United States, but he has a demonstrated intermediate range capability, and he has a demonstrated nuclear weapon capability. Now, and that happened while the rhetoric and the actions were amped up, right? So unless, you know, things are going on behind the scenes that I'm not aware of, I don't know actually how much the Trump administration necessarily had to do with that, because of course there are obviously very interested local actors who are also doing things at the same time. The South Korean president was very interested in better relations with North Korea, right?
China.
And of course, yeah, China exactly is essentially the patron state of North Korea, right? What they're doing as well in terms of also, you know, cracking down a little bit on trade with North Korea, you know, arguably that, you know, could have been Trump's sort of more confrontational stance towards China as well in certain cases, right, in terms of trade and so forth, that, you know, a little bit of arm twisting, maybe that helped, right? But I generally don't, you know, that's, you know, as I was saying, you know, I personally, I don't think there's a problem with offering a meeting with the president. You know, nothing's really worked now, why not try this? Why not try something different? Right. I am a lot less sanguine on the outlook for what's going to come of this, right? Because essentially North Korea or Kim Jong-un sees himself as bargaining from a position of strength. You know, he has, you know, whatever, six or a dozen nuclear weapons that he knows works. You know, he has missiles that he knows works, right? And that wasn't the case before in previous negotiations with North Korea. They were attempting to get the capability. Now they actually have it.
Right.
And, you know, for Kim Jong-un, that might just be the security he needs to essentially engage more with other countries. But I also think for that very reason is that he would not give up that capability, precisely because it gives him the security to negotiate and to actually be, okay, yeah, we can end this war now. Right. I'm secure. I have my nuclear arsenal. I can't be touched, really, right? I mean, I find it, and, you know, again, anything can happen. You know, this is, you know, the Cold War ended. Nobody saw it coming, right? I would be really surprised if he were to voluntarily give up his nuclear weapons, because then he would be putting the trust of his regime in the hands of another country.
Right.
And it just wouldn't make any sense, right? And people have asked me about the comparisons with the end of the Cold War, right? You know, well, you know, that ended and so forth, and you had these dictatorial regimes which collapsed and stuff. The issue there is that Kim Jong-un doesn't have a soft landing pad. You know, I mean, if his regime falls, he's going to be in The Hague, yeah. right? He'll be charged with all sorts of heinous crimes because he's a pretty heinous right. individual, right? In a way that goes far beyond even the communist dictatorships in Eastern Europe, right? I mean, these guys in Eastern Europe, they could enter the political process and get voted out of office, but not essentially fear for their life. And right. Kim Jong-un, it's just not, he doesn't have the same off-ramp, essentially. You know, no. If he were to basically give up his nukes and then, you know, I mean, I just don't see how this ends actually in a good way. What I think Kim Jong-un would probably do, he'd give him an opportunity to show magnanimity, so his magnanimity, releasing prisoners, benefiting from increased engagement with other countries, economic benefits for his people, but I just don't see him giving up nuclear weapons. I mean, but I could be wrong.
And then I have sort of a question that might be more conjecture, might be more far mm-hmm. out, but what do you think the role of climate change is in mm-hmm. changing the future of foreign policy, international well. Relations? We have maybe resource scarcity being mm-hmm. a new issue that maybe we didn't know about before, ice caps melting, opening possibly new trade routes, new territorial disputes, mm-hmm. and then also even peasant farmer bases in many countries in Africa, Middle East, being unsettled because of new rain patterns that are disrupting their farming, it's causing upheaval. What do you think climate change, as broad of a theme as it is, mm-hmm. could play out in the future?
Yeah, I mean, basically nothing good, right? You know, I mean, there's no, you know, I mean, maybe Russia is sort of happy because then they can essentially expand agriculture into Siberia or whatnot, you know, after the permafrost all collapses. You know, there's just nothing, this is just not good in so many, you know, ways. You've got, I mean, most directly probably, well, I actually don't know. I mean, well, in terms of, I mean, most directly now where you're seeing some impacts and more is going to be rising sea levels, you know, where you have a lot of urban metropolitan areas, also in developed countries, which are essentially at or below sea level. It's just going to be a huge amount of economic dislocation that will cost, you know, into the trillions of dollars to handle, manage, whatever you want to call it, right? You know, the way it looks, I think I was talking with Dan Dudney, basically, we've already essentially got a 20-foot ocean level increase sort of baked in now at this point with global temperatures. It just has to eventually equilibrate, you know, which is depressing enough, you know.
That'd be good.
when we moved to the D.C. area, I made sure our house was
above the smoke line.
Probably,
nice little hill.
Exactly right. No, but, you know, it's just, it's going to be something where I'm assuming, particularly, and of course, those that suffer the most will be the poorest and weakest countries, right? Mm-hmm. They tend to be in areas that are more adversely affected by climate change, and they have the least resources to deal with it, right? So you're going to see probably, you know, further impoverishment, dislocation, you know, weakness of institutions, migrations, all that kind of stuff. I mean, in the temperate zones, you're going to see more tropical diseases. We now have to worry about Zika in Maryland and all this stuff. You know, I mean, it's like, this is just going to be a huge cost. And so, you know, sort of some boon you know, now there will be a Northwest Passage. You know, I guess that's nice, but it's sort of like, you know, kind of like, you know,
it's like one pro in like a list of 10 cons. Yeah.
Well, and again, you know,
for
the folks of Siberia, possibly Canada, you know, you'll see better weather. Although, you know, apparently in Canada, what you're going to have is you're going to have quite a bit of drying out. Of the Western Canadian Plains, right? Because it's there's water there and it's wet there because it's cold. But it actually doesn't rain that much in the shadow of the Rocky mm-hmm. Mountains and the Canadian Rockies. So if there's climate change, you're going to essentially have this aridification, this desertification up there. So it's not clear that that's like great, you know, either. Mm-hmm. So it's just all bad. I mean the problem with models is, you know, these sort of like these climate change models, you know, there's just a lot of variance in what couldn't happen. You know, apparently things are changing faster than most models have predicted, but I mean, I'm not, certainly not an authority on that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, just all bad.
All right. Well, thank you for that.
Sure, no problem.
Professor Schmidt, on behalf of the SLC, we want to thank you for coming in. It was truly an enlightening conversation, and thank you very much.
Well, great way to study for the final.
There you go, guys. That's right. Yeah, yeah. Get this podcast out to the folks.
ASAP. Right? I honestly will try to. Just quick couple things before we wrap up. Mm-hmm. Remember to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Hopkins POFA. Remember to go to us on the iTunes store. Give us a 5-star rating. Give us a comment. Anything you want. It'll help us spread our publicity. And also, if you have feedback, please remember to email us at hopkinspofa@gmail.com. We really want to hear from you guys.
Or slide in our DMs.
Or find us in real life.
Yeah. Once again, thank you, Professor Schmidt.
Well, thank you. Thanks for inviting me. It was a pleasure.